Okay, great. We are going to get started. Great to see you all to learn a little bit of Mishnah with you. And I'm just picking up where Jeremy left off. They had a girl, her name is Gavi, and everyone's healthy, thank God. So we're wishing them a really big mazel tov. And meanwhile, we're gonna pick right back up with Masechet Sota. Always jump in, always fun to jump in learning Sota with folks. So we're gonna pick up where you left off. My understanding is that you got up to the second Mishnah in the sixth chapter of Sota. So that is where we will begin in this high drama scene. Okay, and I'm just gonna read through the Mishnah and then stop after you've seen the whole Mishnah to ask for questions in chat, or you can raise your hand and use that function. And we'll ask for any questions after we've gotten through the full Mishnah here. Mishnah Bet. Amar eid echad, ani ri'itiha shenit met, lo haita shota. So if one witness comes along and says, I saw her, that she was defiled, right? You've seen this language, defilement, referring to having seen that actually the sex act occurred, not just that she was secluded, but nitmet, she was actually defiled. If one witness comes and says that that has happened, lo haita shota, she would not drink the sota waters. So this is different than what we are used to seeing for most cases of testimony that require two witnesses. And we'll add what we've already seen and learned here, that for sota, the Mishnah establishes that you also need two witnesses for two earlier points in the process, ede kinoi, right? Witnesses that that the husband has told her that she cannot be secluded with a particular person, and ede stira, witnesses who have actually seen the seclusion. Both of those steps in the process require two witnesses, but here we see that ed echad, if one witness then comes along and says, nitmet, she actually has been defiled, that stops the process right here. She does not go ahead and drink the waters. Below od, ella afilu eved, afilu shifcha, hare elu ne'emanin, af lefosla miketubata. So, not only this, not only one witness, someone whose testimony is usually credible, but even somebody whose testimony is not usually credible, even an eved, a male servant or a maid servant, and these are also trusted. Their testimony is also trusted here. And even so far as disqualifying her from receiving her ketubah. So not only in terms of not drinking the waters, but lefosla miketubata, to take away her rights to the ketubah money. Then we get a kind of middle category here of witnesses. Chamota, uvat chamota, vitzarata, vivimta, uvat ba'ala, hare elu ne'emanot, velo lefosla miktubata, ela shelo tishte. So then we have a series of people here who, by virtue of their particular relationship to the wife, they're somewhat suspect in their testimony. So Chamota, her mother-in-law, Bat Chamota, the mother-in-law's daughter, Ayivimta, her sister-in-law, Bat Ba'ala, the daughter of her spouse. All of these people who might have some kind of negativity in their relationship with the wife, so they might be motivated for ulterior motives, they are trusted in terms of her not drinking. So hare elu ne'emanot, they are trusted in terms of her not drinking the water. If they say nitmet, she was defiled, then that stops the process. She does not drink the sota waters. But since their testimony is a little bit suspect, it's not fully treated as testimony, velo lefosla miktubata, their testimony does not disqualify her from receiving her ketubah. So she still would get her money, but does not drink the waters. That is the first Mishnah we will do together, where again, the idea is introducing that one witness's testimony, and even one witness who's not usually considered credible can count. And we have two different categories here, those whose testimony both prevents her from drinking the water and makes her lose her ketubah money, because their testimony is fully trusted, and those whose testimony only prevents her from drinking the waters, but doesn't go so far as her losing money. Okay, I'm gonna pause here for any comments or questions that, again, you are welcome to chat. Yes, Judith Hellerstein.
Yes, hi. So there were two wives?
Could there be two wives?
Because it says the rival's wife.
Yes, Tzarata. Yeah, so there could be a situation where there are two wives, or even more potentially. The Mishnah does allow for that. It is something where it seems like we have traditions that there was a bit of a split at a later point between the land of Israel and Babylonia, where in the land of Israel there was maybe a little bit more resistance to multiple wives. But in any case, in the Mishnah, it is considered valid to have more than one wife. And so yes, if a co-wife, right, the rival wife, says that that she was defiled, we can imagine that there might be some ulterior motive there. So her word is not fully trusted to the point of losing her ketubah. There's quite a lot of drama in this Mishnah. And you could use this Mishnah as the jumping off point for any number of Mishnaic soap operas.
I'm wondering if part of the reason that she doesn't lose her ketubah is because there's possible financial interest in the other wife or the mother-in-law or other relatives in the family.
Yes. Okay, great. So right, we were saying that their testimony is sort of believed, not fully believed. And yes, you're pointing out that their relationship and the ulterior motive they might have might be specifically financial, meaning there will be more money for them if the if this wife loses her ketubah. So yes, that is certainly true. They actually have a financial incentive to...
But on the other hand, I'm wondering also that often there's jealousy and bitterness and these in-law things. I'm wondering why their testimony is believed at all.
Okay, great point, right? It could be that even without that financial interest, a co-wife would be happier to have her husband all to herself in this system. And so, yes, simply getting to the point where this wife would be sort of kicked out, even if there's no loss of ketubah, would be problematic enough. So this is where it's a difficult thing, because remember, we have already had the two witnesses for two earlier stages, right, who've established that there is some problem here, and they would need to be adhering to all of the usual criteria for witnesses, and so therefore should not have a vested interest, ideally. So that there's that lead up, building up to this Eid Echad stage. And the idea is that even though generally we might not fully trust these people because of the backdrop of there already having been this warning that two witnesses have testified to, and that she's secluded herself that two witnesses have testified to, then that is, it's called reglaim ledavar. It's given some sort of basis to believe what would usually be more questionable testimony.
So if we have those two witnesses that, if we have the two witnesses that are credible, why do we care about the other witnesses? Why do we care about the wife or the mother-in-law or whatever?
Right. So this is where we have, so the idea is there's been two witnesses to attest to the husband warning his wife, and there's been two witnesses that she has nonetheless been secluded. And so the normal procedure would be that then she drinks, and then we see what happens based on drinking. But what we see here, I mean, you maybe talked about this throughout, right? There's some aversion to following that process of drinking, whether because God's name is destroyed, or because, right, the rabbis usually like systems that favor testimony and evidence rather than the more ritualized kind of spell-like process of drinking the waters. But so here we see that the one witness is enough to kind of push off that need for drinking. That is the idea.
I'm wondering about the lohayata shota. Sounds like a conditional grammar. I'm talking about the grammar, a grammatical thing. Why not lo shota? That's what you usually have. She drinks or doesn't drink. Lohayata shota sounds like hedging your bets, or it's a condition. So yeah. I don't get the grammar of it.
Thank you. Okay, well, I'm going to use that question as an opportunity to say something, meaning it sounds like it's a little bit more narrative form, right? Literally means she would not drink. Rather than being more prescriptive, she doesn't or shouldn't drink. And I'm just going to pick up on that comment to say there's like a whole field of study around narrative and law, and specifically in the Mishnah, the way narrative structures might be part of even a legal text. And part of the discussion of sota is how prescriptive this tractate is supposed to be at all, as opposed to maybe having more of a narrative kind of meaning. There's a book, maybe you've talked about this already, a recent book by in Israel, Yishai Rosenzvi, where his book is called Hatekes Shelo Haya, the right, R-I-T-E, the right that was not. And his claim is that sota and this ritual, the way it's described in the Mishnah, never happened as such. It's really serving more of a narrative than a legal function. And that is playing out kind of rabbinic themes and maybe some kind of rabbinic fantasy around gender and sexuality and how to have some sense of religious approach to gender and sexuality. And so I would say here that maybe that language you could see, right, lo haita shota, right, it sounds like it's more descriptive rather than prescriptive. Sure. And it could be that that's part of painting a picture more than giving a sort of legal description. I'm not saying too much on this one little verb. And I don't know, we would want to look at other places that you have a similar formulation, which I don't have off the top of my head. I hope that was interesting, even if not an answer to your question.
I had a question in the chat, but I don't know how to raise my hand by the with the device. I'm sorry. But the question
okay,
was maybe
in
very,
the chat. Let me.
The question was very simple. I mean, or maybe the question is too simple, but I was simply asking, what is the legal effect of, it says she should not drink or she was not to drink, whichever it is, in the case of the of certain witnesses. What is the legal effect of that? That's been unclear to me throughout, actually. So she doesn't drink. I understand the effect if it's a powerful physical effect or whatever, if it's an abortifacient or whatever it might be, the waters. But what is the effect? She gets the ketubah rights, but she's not required to drink. So where does she stand? What's the legal effect?
So the legal effect, it seems, is that her marriage is over. It's just that she gets her ketubah rather than losing her ketubah.
She just, the waters are left out of it because it's not necessary then.
Right. If the waters are there only to respond to a case of uncertainty, then, I mean, it's actually, well, however you feel about all the crazy stuff that's happening in this tractate and the assumptions around gender and sexuality that occur, which I assume you've talked about to some extent, it is interesting legally from a perspective of doubt. Meaning having enough certainty that there might be some problem here, but still having a significant level of doubt, that's when the waters jump in, where there's some gap in sort of the usual ways of having evidence legally. And so because of that doubt, with some level of suspicion, because as the rabbis establish it, there's been witnesses to the warning and to the seclusion, but then there's doubt about what actually happened in that room, that's when the waters enter in a case of doubt. So if there is something that is pushing us to one side around that doubt, which here is the testimony from one witness, even a not particularly credible witness, then the waters are no longer the mechanism to use because we're not in the realm of doubt. move on to Mishnah Gimel here for our last 12 minutes to go through some nice legal logic. So here we're going to get the legal reasoning for why we do something that is totally bizarre in rabbinic law, which is to trust one and trust another. I'm reading from usual law. Mishnah Gimel. Shehaya Badin. It would have been logical to say the following, okay? And this is an amazing Mishnah. We actually don't get a lot of Mishnayot like this. That spell out the full legal reasoning. We're going to engage here in a Mishnah that's doing what we usually see in Midrash, that companion genre to the Mishnah, early Midrash, not the fun narratives like Bereishit Rabbah, and Midrash from the time of the same ages, the time of the Mishnah, behind this here. And I will just say to preface this, right, what is so fascinating about this and all of the examples of this kind of legal reasoning in rabbinic sources is the relationship between your intuition, what you think on your own logic, and the text, right? What a verse comes to teach you. What is the interplay and relationship between your own logic and the revealed? This is logical if you were left to your own legal reasoning devices. Uma im edut rishona she'ein osarta isur olam eina mitkayemet befachot mishnayim edut achrot osarta isur olam eina mitkayemet befachot mishnayim. So this is what this means. Uma, here ma followed by ein odin. We're going to translate my hair as just as or now if. Now, if the edut rishona, the initial testimony, meaning the testimony that she was secluded, she'eno sarta isur olam, doesn't make her forever forbidden to her spouse because it all depends on drinking the waters. If she drinks the waters and she's fine, then she can remain married to her spouse. So that testimony of seclusion, edestira, doesn't forbid her forever. Eina mitkayemet befachot mishnayim, and that testimony can't be established with fewer than two, meaning we require two witnesses for something that isn't particularly severe, right? Two witnesses to prove that she's been secluded. And the implications of that testimony just mean that she has to drink water. Don't make her forbidden to her spouse forever. Edut achrona she'osarta isor olam. So the latter testimony, meaning what we just talked about in the previous Mishnah, the testimony from one witness that she actually was defiled, not just secluded in the room, but defiled. And that testimony has high stakes. Osarta isor olam. It makes her forbidden to her husband forever. That's the end of that marriage. Eino din shelo titkayem befachot mishnayim. Isn't it only logical that this latter testimony, the testimony that she was defiled, only be established with two witnesses? The stakes are so high. We should need two witnesses to declare her forbidden to her husband rather than just relying on one witness. So that's what you would think if you only had your legal logic. If we need two witnesses for seclusion, then of course we would need two witnesses that she was defiled, right? Which would lead you to a different conclusion than what we just saw in the previous Mishnah, that one witness is enough. So that would have been your logical thinking, but now we have the verse coming to deflect that. Talmud Lomar, the verse comes to teach us, quote, Ve'ed ein ba. This is very apropos in terms of this week's parsha. Ve'ed ein ba. There was no witness there. But that part of what the verse in the book of Bamidbar says to establish the case of Sota is Ve'ed ein ba. There are no witnesses. Kol edut sheyesh ba. So what does that mean? That means if there is any kind of testimony, if there are any witnesses, then that is enough to take her out of the category of sota, to take her out of the category of the suspected adulteress. She's not just suspected anymore. We have a situation where you cannot say about it, aid ain ba, there was no witness, because there was a witness. There was one witness. So this is where we see the verse teaches you, even with one witness, she is not considered sota, and she doesn't go through this ritual and doesn't drink the water. So once we've gone through that line of thinking, we're now going to kind of flip that on its head. Now that we've established you only need one witness to say that she was defiled, we're going to start from there. Kal vachomer la'idut harishona me'ata. But now I would make a logical deduction to the earlier testimony from this latter testimony about her being defiled. And this is what I would say logically. Uma im edut achrona she'osarta isor olam, harehi mitkayemet be'ed achad. If for this final testimony saying that she was defiled, and that is going to forbid her to her spouse forever, that can be established with only one witness, even though the stakes are so high. Edut harishona she'ein osarta isor olam, that earlier testimony that she was secluded, that doesn't forbid her forever. It's contingent, right? It just requires her to drink the waters. Wouldn't it be only logical that that lower stakes testimony could be established with just one witness? If one witness is enough to make her forbidden forever, then shouldn't one witness be enough to make her drink the waters? That's what I would think if I was left to my own logical devices. But now we have a different verse. Talmud Lomar, ki matza va ervat davar. So here we're jumping books. And the verse teaches, in a totally separate situation, talking about divorce in Deuteronomy. If a man wants to divorce his wife, because the verse says, matza va ervat davar, he has found something that is unseemly, which is interpreted here as zinut, right? That she's been promiscuous. Olahalan hu omer al pishne edim yakum davar. And in another part of Deuteronomy, in chapter 19, it says that the matter davar, that same word, must be established by two witnesses. So we have the word davar in two places, one about divorce based on promiscuity, and one to establish two witnesses. Malahalan al pishnaim edim, afkan al pishnaim edim. So just like over there in chapter 19, you need two witnesses for a davar, a matter. So too here, when it comes to a man who's deciding to divorce his wife because of his concern that she was promiscuous, and also here, he needs two witnesses for that. And that is why there need to be two witnesses for seclusion, stira, even though one witness is enough to establish nitmet, that she was defiled based on aid in ba. Okay, it was a little complicated. See if there's any clarifying questions here.
I am sorry. I raised my hand during the last discussion, not on this one. So if you don't want to go back there, we don't have to talk about it.
Yeah, so we have a comment here about how we're kind of jumping all over the place in terms of these different verses, right? It's interesting to jump from, I think the main interesting leap is to jump from sota to the general case of divorce in Devarim chapter 24.
If there were two witnesses, wouldn't that make this a case of adultery and take us out of the sota situation entirely?
Right. Okay. Thank you. So this is like, it's so strained throughout Mishnah Sota. What we have just established is that you need two witnesses that she was secluded, edei stira. But if there were two witnesses that she was defiled, right, nitmet, if there were two witnesses to that effect, then you're totally right. This would be in the world of adultery, we would be talking about a capital punishment offense, and that would be something totally different. What we've established is something that the rabbis really seem to construct here, which is the idea that you have these two stages of witnesses for two processes that are not fully legally spelled out in the text in Bamidbar at all, the witnesses for warning, when the husband issues a warning, and the witnesses for seclusion, that they've seen her in a room. And that's where, again, it's the witnesses' testimony there establishes enough credibility for suspicion. You know enough to know that you don't know what happened, right? But that's different than having two witnesses saying, we know what happened. What happened is she was defiled.
But now we do.
Well, so we have one witness. So
we have one witness. So, but I'm just saying, if you required two witnesses then, at that point, I'm making an argument why one witness makes sense. Because if you required two witnesses, you would be out of the SOTA situation entirely. Because now we would have two witnesses of actual sex.
I see what you're saying. Meaning, even if the verse hadn't had that phrase, aid in la, there was no witness with her establishing that one witness is enough, you're saying, I would have already known that you don't need two witnesses because two witnesses would have put me into
precisely
the legal realm of adultery.
That's right. That's precisely the point I'm making.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm just going to say one more thing on this and we're going to close on time at 1:30. I think part of what is happening here in the rabbinic reading of that phrase, aid ein ba, is the rabbis do something else that's really interesting, which is they read the previous phrase in the verse, v'hi lo nitpasa, she was not caught, which it seems like in the biblical text means she was not caught in the act, right? As a kind of precursor to v'eid ein ba, there was no testimony to say that we don't have any evidence around this. And the rabbis read that phrase in a totally different direction. V'hi lo nitpasa, they read as she was not coerced. And I think because that's part of the rabbis wanting to establish that she was caught in a certain sense. The rabbis want there to be witnesses at some stage in this process. And we don't like the kind of, you know, husband just decides to subject his wife to this by himself. I think that's a piece of what's going on, this sort of dance between wanting testimony for parts of this, but not full testimony, so that there's still some level of doubt. Okay, we're going to sign off here. Sorry to go 2 minutes over. Great to see you all. We'll jump in again tomorrow. And lovely learning this with you. An exciting topic.